Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. They're called comfort pets, and there are dogs and cats and even rabbits that greet those who need only the love that a pet can provide. So comfort pets visit hospitals or nursing homes and domestic violence shelters and even prisons. One Kansas City group, Pets for Life, points out that animals are a common denominator through which people of all ages and capabilities can communicate and express their love. Today we'll take a look at comfort pets with Dr. Wayne Hunhausen. And he's an animal behavior specialist. We'll take your questions about your pet's unusual behavior later on this hour. And also with us in our first segment this morning is Judy Thomason. She is vice president of Pets for Life, and she's joined by her golden retriever here named Bella, right?
Right.
Good to have you, Judy.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Now, what is it about pets that make them so effective in difficult environments like hospitals, Judy?
Well, they are a very calming influence, and they also bring part of normal life into a hospital or a nursing home or wherever we happen to go. Everybody loves pets, but they're not available in these kinds of facilities often, although more places are beginning to have in-house mm-hmm. pets or in-house dog. But I think it lowers blood pressure, and it decreases anxiety with children. They feel more confident about talking to an animal than sometimes they do an adult.
Yeah, sure.
They say that risk of heart attack is reduced, and it also stimulates good speech and language because sometimes we see people who don't talk very much.
Mm-hmm.
And when they see an animal come in, suddenly they're beginning to verbalize.
You know, Wayne Hunhausen, how long has this idea of comfort pets been around? I mean, we're going back a few decades here, aren't we?
Oh, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Probably at least 25, 30 years. And, you know, besides some of the things that she's mentioned, these people that are having post-traumatic problems, you know, in dealing with house loss and family loss, like we've had here recently with the tornadoes, they provide a focus so you can mm-hmm. pay attention to the pet and get away from your thoughts that are really depressing. And the other thing, there's been really some really interesting studies lately. Early on, there were studies that looked at decreased in blood pressure and heart rate by stroking a dog or a cat,
yeah.
And more recently, they're looking at some neurotransmitter changes, and they find that people interact with pets have increased dopamine activity, serotonin activity, oxytocin activity, and all these can produce a physiologic calming effect on people when they're interacting.
You know, Judy, I'm wondering, when you go into a hospital, how do you engage patients with your pet Bella there?
Well, quite often it's the patient who engages first.
Oh, really?
In that they say, oh, come in here. I want to see you. I want to pet your dog.
Mm-hmm.
They are just thrilled to death. Sometimes I get the feeling in the rehab rooms that they stop doing the activity that they're not real crazy about doing so they can pet the dogs. But
things come to a halt pretty quickly,
saying. Yes, they do. And they're anxious to see the pets. They reach out. They use motor skills. And so quite often it's actually the clients themselves that engage.
So, Judy, you take Bella into hospitals and where else? Where else do you
take
her?
We go to hospitals. We go to hospice. We go to detention centers. We go to Ronald McDonald House. We go St. Joseph Hospital has a big program with Pets for Life. We have a program where the dogs go into the schools and read with the children who are kind of reluctant readers.
Mm-hmm.
And the dogs are very non-threatening, so they can read and not be worried. And a lot of times their reading improves because of that.
No, Wayne, I gather that not every dog is sort of geared to be a comfort pet. What characteristics are people looking for a good comfort pet here?
Probably the temperament of the pet is most important.
Laid back, easy going, right?
Exactly. Laid back, easy going, ability to be trained readily. You're not going to consider a dog that's real reactive, certainly not one that might be aggressive or fearful, but a stable temperament is the most important thing.
How do you train them, Judy?
Well, we have a program at Pets for Life that all of our applicants go through, in that they go through an orientation. without their pet, and then they go through a pretest process where the pet is evaluated based on strengths and weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
And then if there are some weaknesses, there's someone there to help them work on that. And then when they really feel like they're ready, they take our final temperament test. And most of that's comprised of obedience skills. And we look at calmness, and we look at how they recover from distractions, because you do get a lot of distractions wherever we go.
Mm-hmm.
It's not bad to react, but then can you recover quickly from that?
I gather that not all pets are accepted into the program.
There are some that it's just not suitable for, and that they wouldn't be very happy doing it. So that's going through that process helps owners find out that kind of thing.
Do the owners tend to sort of understand that? Can they anticipate what the answer is going to be as they go through your program?
I think they can.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes I think owners underestimate their pets in that animals can really rise to the occasion when you really think maybe they won't.
Yeah.
So it helps them in both a positive way, but it also gives them a realistic picture.
That's the voice of Judy Thomason. She is vice president for a group in town called Pets for Life. You know, Wayne, I gather that puppies don't make good comfort pets. I mean, at least in the sense that you're taking them around to different settings. So we're looking at somewhat middle-aged animals probably here for the most part.
Right. Young adult animals are going to be the better ones. And a couple problems with puppies is they're just starting to learn about their environments, and so you might have some problems where they might be skittish or fearful in those situations. And they tend to be pretty rambunctious, and that's difficult. And also house training lapses are a little more likely in those young kids. So more mature pets work out much better.
And Judy, you actually have a rabbit that serves as a comfort pet?
We do. The rabbit actually is carried in a basket, and the rabbit is a very, very big favorite with children, and loves to be stroked and petted and held and cuddled. And
why aren't there more rabbits in the program? Why is that something that's considered a little bit unusual?
I really don't know why we don't have more rabbits. It may be just a matter of someone taking the time to work with their rabbit and get them used to being carried in a basket, that kind of thing. But I really don't know, because they're certainly popular when we have them.
Would rabbits make good comfort pets, the typical rabbit, Wayne?
If they're socialized real well. And one of the reasons
one
of the reasons that you don't see them is they're just not that popular a pet. We have much more dogs and cats and other pets in the pet owning population. But whether it's a rabbit or a dog or a cat, that early socialization just in general is important. But in particular, if you're going to a real variety of environments and situations.
Yeah. Judy, I'm wondering how long Pets for Life has been around.
We have been around almost 30 years.
And you have how many volunteers?
We have 197 volunteer teams, meaning the owner and their pet.
Yeah.
And we go to almost 99 facilities now.
99
that we visit.
Facilities that you visited in the area then. Yeah. Does an organization typically contact you, or do you call them?
They usually contact us and let us know that they're interested in having regular visits from a Pets for Life team.
Mm-hmm.
And we have two wonderful volunteer coordinators in the office that work in the mornings. And they take all that information, and then the process goes from there.
And the volunteers themselves own the animals, right?
Yes.
Does one breed of dog, for instance, tend to be the most successful comfort pet, Wayne?
Well,
I mean, I'm thinking of Goldens, obviously. Yeah.
Goldens are going to be right up at the top.
Standard
poodles, I think, are real social dogs, and I think they do real well. Some of the dogs that tend to be more reactive, some of the terriers or might have a little bit higher failure rate as far as going through testing and so forth. But any breed dog is potential candidate, I think. But again, a lot of it goes back to really starting out with that early socialization, you know, having the pet have a lot of environmental experiences and early training.
Do you ever take cats in this program?
We have three wonderful cats.
Really?
They also ride in baskets.
Mm-hmm.
And they're phenomenal. We have had one in the past who always rode in a little red wagon. and the patients who are bedridden love to have the cats because they can curl up on their laps. Yeah.
Can't do that with a golden.
No.
Well, if somebody out there listening to this wants to connect with you, mm-hmm. how can they do it?
We have a website, which is www.petsforlifeglobal.global.
.global. Okay. Well, if you're not sure, we'll double check it and we'll put it on our website later on today. Denny Alexander's signaling me here that we'll get that. Well, Judy, it's been such a pleasure to have you. Thanks for coming in, and thank you for bringing Bella with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having us.
Again, that's Judy Thomason. She is Vice President of Pets for Life. We're joined now by Tim Hetzner, who is President of Lutheran Church Charities. He's also a handler for the LCC Comfort Dogs that were on the ground in Newtown, Massachusetts, the day after the horrific shootings there last December. Tim, good morning. Nice to have you.
Good morning.
Tell us about Newtown and what you did there, Tim.
Well, in Newtown, we were invited in. We never go anyplace we're not invited. We were invited in and arrived the day after the shootings and used our dogs through one of our churches in that area. We generally work through one of our churches, mm-hmm. and we're out in the community, and then for the first day and the preceding 2 weeks after that, he had our dogs into the high school because the elementary school was not open until first week in January.
The high school, were the elementary kids at the high school then, Tim?
Well, they had a facility that was open that parents could bring their elementary school children to. And so we had some dogs stationed over there, others at the high school. And then we were asked to come into the new Sandy Hook School that they opened in the first week in January. Mm. And so we were there on the first day of class, and we still have dogs in that school right now. Mm. And have been asked to stay through school.
Tim, give me a sense of how your dogs were received those first few days, because I'm just guessing it must have been quite a moment for the kids to see
phenomenal.
Those dogs.
I mean, it was for many people, and that was not just dogs, but first responders and parents and other people in the community. In many cases, the being able to talk about what took place or what they're feeling, they talk to the dog before they talk to a human. And so it was rewarding to see that, because an important part of the healing process, particularly in a tragedy situation, is to be able to talk about it.
How about the elementary school kids themselves, Tim?
Oh, many of them. They said, "I'll talk to the dog. I won't talk to anybody else." and so we'd witness them talking to the dog and sharing what happened. In some cases, in their classroom, for those that were survivors, to others, as they left the school and remember that scene. Others sharing about somebody they knew that was killed. So it was a very healing part of it. And the counselors that were at the school used our dogs in their serving the students in helping the students process what they're through, and still do.
Tim, I just want to picture this in my mind as you're describing this to me. I see second, third, fourth grade kids face-to-face with these dogs, literally telling them what happened to them.
Right, right.
Wow, wow.
And, they don't just walk up to the dog and start talking to
sure,
them. They walk
of course.
Up and they pet the dog, and then they start talking shortly after that once they are calmed by the dog and start talking to the dog. Or in some cases, our dogs will just lay down on the ground, and they'll lay down right on top of the dog.
Yeah. You know, I noticed, Tim, that you spent a lot of time in Moore, Oklahoma, just in the last couple of weeks. I think you were there for an entire week after the tornado blew through there.
We are still there. We've had dogs constantly out there. In fact, I flew my third team of dogs in yesterday.
Tell us how that situation came down and how your animals were received down there.
Basically the same thing. You know, tragedy is tragedy, whether it's a bombing or a shooting or, you know, we've been at all of them. Tragedy is tragedy. And those that were directly affected, like in Moore that had lost homes, or those that had lost people they knew, or those in the surrounding community had their homes damaged, but they could still live in them, but they still didn't have electricity for a number of days. So we worked in that area, again, through one of our churches there that was also a distribution center for food and clothing and other items. So we'd have the dogs there. So when people came in, they could spend time with the dogs if they chose to. And in many cases, which what we see now is they come back, they look on the Facebook. Each of our dogs have their own Facebook page. So they look at the Facebook page to see if the dogs, where the dog is going to be at that morning or afternoon or evening, and we'll show up then to spend time with the dog.
Did you ever walk the streets of Moore, Oklahoma with
your
animals?
Yeah, we did as much as we could. You know, the first days you weren't allowed in there, but when they did open it up, but that first day they opened it up, they had the heavy rains, and so it flooded, actually. So, but we were on the ground there, as in the areas that was safe to be in and safe for the dogs to be in, because there's still a lot of debris in the ground. So we spent times at points where people went into where their homes were and stayed with them, and in some cases went out right to their house if requested.
Well, if our listeners have had any encounters with comfort dogs and want to share their stories, 816-235-2888, our email address, UpToDate at KCUR.org, or tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. Amy from Lenexa. Amy, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for doing this program.
Sure.
I live in Lenexa, and I'm a volunteer with another group in town called Pet Partners, similar concept. And I just wanted to comment on a couple things. One is, I have a friend who lives in Newtown, and she taught at the school, retiring in May, and her children went to Sandy Hook. And having those Lutheran comfort dogs there has struck her considerably, and the children there. And she's been posting to my wall every time the comfort dogs are in town, and even when they went to Moore, she let me know because it meant so much to her.
Amy, why do you think they're so effective?
Well, I think it's for many people, everyone has some relationship with a dog, whether they had a dog, have a dog, knew someone who had a dog, for the most part. And you can't necessarily, if you're in a hospital, in a nursing home, you can't have a conversation or have a relationship with your pet. And so when you go in those situations, it creates that memory.
Yeah,
it lets them live it. I've seen tears. I've seen joy. It runs the gamut. And as much as it means to the people we visit, we get it back tenfold.
You bet. Amy, I'm glad you called. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Tim Hetzner, you only use Goldens, right?
Correct.
Why?
Well, because they're good. They're good both indoors and outdoors, number one. They tend to be one of the most likable dogs. And Goldens, by nature, are lovers. So, you know, it's easier for us to use just one breed. You know, we have breeders for our dogs, and we start training them when they're 5 weeks old. So we spent a year basically training a dog before it's placed in one of our churches and schools. Our dogs are not owned by individuals, so it's we place them in a church or school to be used in that setting and in that community. And then when there is a disaster, we can deploy them out to the disaster area. You know, we were in Boston, we were in Newtown, we were in Waco, we're in Oklahoma now, we were in Sandy, Superstorm Sandy. Any place there's a disaster that we're invited into, we bring dogs in from. We have dogs now in 8 states and soon to be 10.
Hey, Tim, how do you travel with the dogs? You go by plane, train, everything?
Well, we travel on ground many times, or in other places we will fly, and we've had some people that have volunteered their personal planes, like going into Oklahoma yesterday. We had someone here in the Chicago area that had a plane that flew that team in to Oklahoma, and we'll pick them up in a week. So it's all three. We haven't done train yet. We've had our bus, but we've done ground transportation and airplanes.
Tim Hetzner is president of Lutheran Church Charities. Tim, thanks so much for taking some time. Really enjoyed having you.
You're welcome.
You bet. It's time for a break. When we come back, Dr. Wayne Hunhausen will remain with us. He'll be fielding your questions about your pet's behavior. You can call us 816-235-2888. You can email us UpToDate at kcur.org or tweet us at kcurUpToDate. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed Friday's talk with the prolific Mexican artists Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera about their work and the new exhibition at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, you can find it at kcur.org. ExxonMobil is one of the world's largest energy corporations, so why do we know so little about it? Tomorrow on the show, we'll unearth some of the company's secrets, plus a look at the current troubles of the Kansas City Royals. One more year down the drain here. Well, Dr. Wayne Hunhausen of the Westwood Animal Hospital is still with us. We're talking about your pet's behavior, your questions. Does your dog bark too much? Does your cat hiss too much? Wayne oftentimes has the answers for you. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, UpToDate at kcur.org. Well, Wayne, a lot of families will be heading out of town in the next few weeks on summer vacations, and they'll be wondering what to do with a family dog or cat. You recommend what?
Well, it depends on a number of things.
How long they're gone,
how they're traveling, how the pet does by itself or with the family and so forth. So if you're going to travel with the pets, you want to call ahead, make sure that if you're staying, that they allow pets, or if they don't, that there's a boarding facility nearby that you can make reservations. Another thing to consider is that you've got good identification on the pet, and not only a collar with your cell phone information, but I would highly recommend a microchip. So if the pet's loses its collar, most veterinary hospitals and shelters can scan for a wide variety of manufactured microchips.
And microchips go where on the pet?
They're a little bit smaller than a grain of rice, and they're injected under the skin between the shoulder blades.
So fatty tissue up there probably, right?
Usually there's a little bit of fatty tissue. American pets, a lot of fatty tissue, unfortunately. But, yes, they typically do real well. The pets tolerate the application well. And it's a safe procedure.
Okay.
Like benefits. Yeah, I've always microchipped my pets.
And not a big deal to do that either, I don't imagine.
No. As a matter of fact, we do a lot of those when the pets are neutered and spayed. It's a perfect time when they're under the anesthetic to do it. But they don't have to be anesthetized to do that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's go to some calls already stacking up for Dr. Wayne Hunhausen here. Gloria from Overland Park. Gloria, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi, Gloria.
Hi, how are you?
Go ahead, Gloria. Yeah. Fire away.
Okay, I have a rescue dog. He is 1 year old. We are his third home. He is very, very skittish. He is spiteful of men, mostly, but he does not come to anyone other than myself, and I'm home with him all day long. So he has more of a chance with me. He is also a barker, a high-pitched barker.
Yeah.
But the main thing that I'm worried about is he will not come to anyone else. So if we had an emergency or whatnot, he would not be able to, you know, to respond. And we just would like some ideas on how we can better help him become comfortable. And this is his forever home, but we are his third. So I understand his distrust, perhaps.
Sure. Well, when you're working with a pet that's afraid of, you have a social fear or object fear, basically you're working under two principles. Is you want to identify the stimulus that causes the fear. In this case, it's a social problem, so it's going to be people, maybe men worse than women. And you also want to identify the distance at which the pet starts showing some anxiety. And you, during the training procedure, when you're counter-conditioning the pet to be relaxed, you don't want to let the pet get close enough to any person where he acts very, very fearful, and you don't want to allow that person to do anything around the pet that makes it anxious. So that's the first thing, is avoidance. The second thing is you have to have some type of plan where in controlled situations you can make good things happen when the pet sees people. And what I would probably do, since the pet is so nervous, can you take him for a walk? Is he okay on a walk without being too skittish?
He's not skittish, but he definitely tugs to come back home.
Okay.
Well, one thing that I would recommend doing is walk him in quiet areas where you might see people periodically, but it's not going to be a bustling area where somebody might come up from behind. You might go out to like Shawnee Mission Park, where these big green spaces where you could get up maybe away from the road and near the wooded areas where he can see people maybe 100, 150 feet away. And you take along really, really palatable food, like little pieces of chicken or fat-free turkey hot dogs or turkey. And as you walk along, watch for people. And as soon as you see somebody, watch his behavior. And the second he orients or looks towards a person, happily give him a piece of food in a really upbeat tone. Or if he'll sit, even better, in an upbeat tone, ask him to sit or sit, stay, and give him the food. And you do this over and over again, so he never gets close enough to anybody where he feels nervous. And whenever he sees somebody, something really good happens, so he starts looking forward to seeing people. And then gradually you take your little exercise closer and closer to people. Now, for people that visit, what I would do is I would put him up, if you'll tolerate this, in another area of the house before somebody comes to the front door. So it might be a bedroom or a crate. Turn up the radio for some background noise. Give him a Kong toy full of cheese or meat or something really good to keep him distracted. Let that person come in, sit on a sofa at the end of a large room, and give that person a little bowl of chicken pieces and tell the person to completely ignore him when he comes in. After 5 or 10 minutes, so you can go get him, bring him in, and sit across the room from the person. And then every time he looks at that person, tell him he's a good boy and give him a little piece of food. And if he's doing well with that, let the person start flipping pieces of food to him, but don't look at him. And so that whenever somebody's in the house, food falls out of the sky, basically. What you do want to avoid is the way people typically want to interact with a pet. You want to come up and lean over and say hello and reach for the dog. And all these things are often interpreted as being threatening behaviors, being looking big and standing over the pet, having a hand come out into that personal space, even if it's just for a sniff, and especially the eye contact. The eye contact from somebody the dog doesn't know is interpreted as being threatening oftentimes, and that makes pet more fearful than more relaxed. So making the person small and sitting on a chair and ignoring eye contact and just flipping pieces of food is the best way for him to learn about people. And then you've got to progress from there. But that's where I would get started.
Very good suggestions. Thank you.
Very good.
You're welcome.
Good luck with it, Gloria.
Thank you so much.
Do they make Kong toys for adults? Those things sound pretty good, Wayne.
Adult people.
Yeah. Sit around, sitting in the office and chew on one all day, right?
Some steak stuck in there
absolutely.
Turns you on, yeah.
Let's go to Michelle from Lee Summit. Michelle, you're on with Dr. Wayne Hunhausen of the Westwood Animal Hospital. Michelle, good morning. You there,
morning.
Michelle? Yeah, hi.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I have a cat who's fairly well-behaved, very social, and the problem we're having now is that recently he started choosing to either urinate or poop on a specific rug in our bathroom. And he doesn't do it all over the house. He doesn't seem sick or anything, but he tends to do it when he's frustrated because he hasn't gotten his fish for the day or something like that. Is there some way to train him or discipline him to keep him from doing that?
Well, the with these type of problems, the first thing, and with behavior problems in general, you have to try to decide what the underlying motivation for the behavior is and address that. If you just treat the symptoms, you're not going to be as successful. And so if it has to do with feeding times, not getting fed at certain times, or not getting fed enough, maybe you can change when you feed him. You might be able, if he's a real hungry kid, you might be able to put him on a higher fiber light diet so he eats more, and so he's less anxious when he's not getting fed at the right time. So if you can address that underlying problem, that's the most important thing.
And he just described my 18-year-old son, Michelle. That's exactly what we're up to there.
He's going on the rugs and you're...
he's got to feed him all the time. That part of it, yeah.
That part, at least.
Yeah.
But that's what you want to try and do, is see what you can do to address the pet's underlying problem and provide for its needs. And then sometimes once you've done that, if the cat's gone in a specific area enough times, you also have to break that habit. And one thing I would do would be make sure that that throw rug is cleaned thoroughly. And then you might set it up, if this is practical, as a feeding station for a month or so, where you leave his food there, maybe his water bowl. If you give him treats, you take him over there to give him treats. You leave his toys there. So he comes back to that rug over and over again each day to eat, to drink, to find toys or get treats. So that starts becoming a living area for him. And those activities are not compatible with eliminating. And that might break that for you if you do that long enough.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Good luck, Michelle. Yeah,
you bet.
Okay. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting with Dr. Wayne Hunhausen, taking your calls about your pet's unusual behaviors. You know, Wayne, this is also a time of year when more people are walking their pets in their neighborhoods, finally with the weather finally warming up, and that means more issues with dogs, you know, doing their business in places where they shouldn't be doing their business. I'm guessing that teaching pets where to do their business is more of a time-consuming task than people think. Am I right about that?
Well, you could do that. And if you don't want to pick up on a walk, then what you do is you start out early, and that's really the key with a puppy, and you take it to a specific area of the yard every time it eliminates. So you're going to use a leash to make sure it goes there, and then you praise it when it goes, and you give it a small food reward. And it's just a matter of consistency, where the pet goes for several months or more, starting young at a young age, only in one part of the yard, so you develop this ability to discriminate between this location and other locations. So you develop a location preference. So it can be done. You can also, plan your when you feed the pet to have some control on when it's going to have to go, so you make sure you get it to the right area if you let the pet out. But you've got to have control over where that pet goes every single time for enough weeks or months in a row to get that done.
I think people have gotten a little better, at least in our neighborhood, about cleaning up afterwards for their pets. And I don't see a lot of issues.
Yeah, we're in the same neighborhood. And I've walked my dog quite a bit, and it seems like that I can't remember the last time I saw somebody that wasn't picking up after the dog.
Nor can I.
That's important for cleanliness, for health issues, and just, to be polite to your neighbors.
Yeah, absolutely. Paris from Parkville. Paris, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I got a new dog, and I adopted him from the Parkville Animal Shelter, and he's a Karen Terrier.
Good for you.
He doesn't bark. He doesn't bark, but he hates thunder. He hates storms, and he gets really restless. And I'm wondering. I read somewhere that you could give him melatonin. Is that a good thing? Or those thunder shirts? Do they work on every dog? How does that work?
Yeah, melatonin. I haven't found that to be very successful. Thunder shirts do seem to help on some dogs. And there was one study done out of Tufts a year or two ago, and they found quite a few dogs seem to be more comfortable in stressful situations, although there was a small study and they didn't feel like it was statistically significant. So if your dog will tolerate a thunder shirt, I think that's worth trying.
And what is a thunder shirt, Wayne?
Well, it's basically a shirt the dog wears that applies pressure. And if you've read any of Temple Grandin's books, she has a woman with autism.
She's been here.
She feels more relaxed, when she's in a contained type of environment. Mm-hmm. And so those seem to help with some pets. So that's certainly worth a try. The other things that you can do, sometimes leaving lights on so the dog can't see the light flashes, that can be helpful. Having background noise, turning the radio or the television up sometimes can help so the pet can't hear the thunder as well. If it's not exceptionally bad, maybe keeping the pet busy by giving it like the Kong toys where the pet rolls it around, the treats come out, or they suck good stuff like chicken or canned dog food out of it. Sometimes that'll help. And unless the pet's really stressed. Now, some of these dogs that I treat actually have panic attacks, and they are dangerous to themselves because of their escape behavior, trying to dig through windows and screens and things like that.
Wow.
And for some of the really severe ones, medication, like some of the anti-anxiety medications we use in people, can be helpful. You could try some Benadryl, though. If the pet's healthy and with the guidance of your veterinarian, you might try a little bit of Benadryl. It's not really an anti-anxiety medication, but it has a mild sedative effect. So you might want to talk to your veterinarian and see if that would be an appropriate medication for your pet.
Well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm, you're welcome.
All right, Paris, good luck with it. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Nikki from Lenexa. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888, and our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Nikki, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, thank you.
I have a beautiful 8-year-old, really big Labrador Retriever. He's been fully housebroken for most of his life, but in the past 3 months, he has suddenly changed his housebreaking habits. He has started defecating mostly at night in the house. He's never done, this is not his usual habit. He leaves us sometimes large piles of surprises at
delightful.
Night. Yeah.
Does the stool seem normal, or is he having
no.
It's not?
No, it's not normal. And we started changing his eating habits. We don't feed him. I started not feeding him after 5. Then we don't feed him after 3. We make sure that he gets the exercise in. We make sure the food is not available after a certain time.
But is the stool is soft, though? It's not.
No, the stool is normal.
Oh, it is normal. Okay.
This is normal stool. Right. It's not runny. You can, you know, it's easy to pick up and,
okay,
you know, dispose of. He's just going in the house.
Okay. Does he sleep in the bedroom with you?
If he sleeps in the bedroom with us, he does not, which is normally where he sleeps, because he sleeps under my desk. He will not do this.
Okay. A couple of things I would recommend is you might want to go for maybe 2 or 3 months, if it's practical, with him tied to the bed. And so that way it's basically like a virtual crate. You know, some people do crate training with their dogs, but most pets want to limit it where they sleep. And so if you tie him to the bed or a piece of furniture next to the bed, he has to either hold it through the night, or if he goes, he's got to go where he's sleeping. And most adult dogs won't do that. So doing that for a few months might help. And then the other thing I'll do with some of these dogs, just have the fecal house soiling. I would do what you've done already, which is feed him earlier, not let him have anything late in the evening. But there is a prescription diet that most veterinarians carry. It's called ID, and it's a very low-fiber diet and produces very little stool. And so sometimes I'll put the dog on the low-fiber stool so it's just not defecating as much during that retraining period for a couple of months, and that might help you out also.
Okay, I'll try that. Yep. Thank you very much.
One other thing I would do is strengthen the behavior that you want, which means that you go back out. When he goes outside, go with him as often as you can, praise him when he eliminates, and give him a small treat for defecating outside to also strengthen the behavior that you want.
Okay, we have recently changed. Everyone now is gone all day long. He does go to doggy daycare about 3 days a week, but there's no one at home for long periods of time. So I don't know if he's suffering from separation anxiety. He just sometimes at night, at like 9 or 10 o'clock when we're ready to go to bed, he just refuses to go outside and go.
Oh,
he just will not go to the bathroom.
So that's your other problem, is he won't go before he goes to bed.
He won't go before he goes to bed.
You might plan on taking him for a long walk prior to bedtime. Sometimes exercise will stimulate elimination. And then the other thing I might look at is, is there something in the yard that's different, that's frightening for him? Maybe you take him outside to the front yard for a while, make sure that there's a light on, if that helps out. I wonder why he's not wanting to go before you go to bed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I will look at that. Thank you, Doctor. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks
for
calling.
Nikki. Yeah, bye-bye now.
All right. Bye-bye.
Let's go to Dan from he's visiting from somewhere. Dan, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm from Seattle, Washington, actually.
Well, welcome.
Thanks. I have a 2-year-old Borzoi who is a really sweet dog, good disposition, but who, when he's separated by some sort of barrier, either a leash or a fence from other dogs, seems to become so aggressive as to become frightening. But when he's not on a leash, or he's at an off-leash dog park or any of those other situations, he behaves well with other dogs. And I really mean that. Mm-hmm. Kind of maybe even a counter to breed. So I'm wondering if you can help me with the dog psychology on that one.
Dan, what is a Borzoi?
Oh, a Russian wolfhound. It's a like a greyhound with long hair of the sighthound breed.
Sure, yeah, I got you.
They're big kids.
Yeah, I was going to say, really big. Yeah.
Well, with the reactivity on leash, you want to approach that similarly to what I just described earlier for the lady that had the fearfully reactive dog. And you want to mentally estimate the distance where he becomes reactive on leash. And you want to take him for walks. Well, he'll see dogs frequently, but never pass over that threshold. So he never gets to a point of high arousal when he sees other dogs. And you take along. Pardon?
That's nearly impossible, because his distance, I've got it down. It's always about 15 yards, which is that's even across the street. It's tough.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that's not uncommon. I see dogs that have thresholds of that are farther than that real frequently. But what you could do, if you can't get out, you know, away into an area where you can walk the dogs without avoiding, you know, getting the dogs too close, just pack him up in the car and go out to a park or a walking trail. And if you're estimating that the threshold distance is maybe 30 feet, then you find an open area where you can be 50 feet from where the dogs are being walked. And every time a dog, he orients towards a dog as fast as you can. You say his name, Rover, sit, stay, just like it's a game, and give him a little piece of meat. And you just do this over and over and over again. And eventually what you'll find is when a dog appears, you'll start noticing that he'll start looking towards you in anticipation of the food. Some dogs even learn to start sitting on their own before you even ask them in anticipation of the food. And gradually you take it closer and closer. So that's one thing that you can do. What you don't want to do is get so close enough where he goes off, and then you have to maybe scold him or pull him back or something, and that ends up being a bad situation for him. So that's how I would address that. And then the problem in the yard, that's much more of a challenge, and you need, because you don't have much space to work on there. So the first thing I would do is work with the problem on a leash, and then give me a call later on if you're doing well with that. We'll talk about the yard, some of the exercises you can do in the yard.
Okay, great. That was really fascinating. Thanks.
Good luck, Dan.
You know, one of the reasons that dogs have a problem on a leash, I think, and they don't have a problem in the dog park, and that's not too uncommon, is that on a leash, the dog's trapped, basically. It can't move more than about 6 feet.
And
so
gets nervous.
It feels nervous about a dog approaching. It's not sure about social interaction with a dog. By having it on a leash, which you need to keep it secure, you've eliminated a strategy, which is avoidance.
And also, people tend
to make things worse, because if you know your dog's going to be reactive, as you start getting close to somebody that's walking your dog down the street, most people tighten up in the leash and are going, leave it, look at me, be good. And I think the dog thinks, gosh, I'm not so sure about dogs. He's not so sure about dogs either because of his tone of voice. I probably need to do something. And they become worse and worse as time goes by.
That all makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Email here from Chris from Kansas City, Wayne. And my question is, what's a good apartment dog?
Quiet dog.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's see. Basset Hound would be a good one. They tend to be fairly quiet, although some of them could be howlers. Oftentimes you think about small spaces and small dogs. Some of the giant breed dogs, like Great Danes even, are pretty good apartment dogs. They're not nearly as active as some of the smaller dogs, like some of the terriers or the herding dogs that need a lot of exercise and move around a lot. Some of these bigger guys end up being pretty much couch potatoes later on in life.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. David from Fairway emailed us this. My dog is well-trained, sits and responds to commands, except for one. She will never come when called, no matter how many treats are offered. We take her out on the leash, otherwise she'll never come back inside. How can we train her to come?
Well, actually, that's interesting. I just posted an article on teaching the new dog to come on our behavior blog last night. And so if you go to westwoodanimalhospital.com and our behavior blog, you'll see an article on that. A little simple exercise that you can start doing is inside at dinner time, if the dog likes its food, or with small little treats, you can practice getting the dog to come by simply throwing a piece of food 8 or 10 feet away so the dog chases after it to make it go away. And then once the dog picks it up, say its name, go, Rover, come, and a really upbeat tone of voice, and then wave your hand towards you with a second piece of food in that hand. And most dogs will come running up, have it sit, give it a piece of food, and then just throw another one down the hallway. And so over and over again, you're associating Rover come and a hand signal when you wave your hand towards you with the behavior coming towards you, and you're rewarding it with food. So I'll usually start there and do that for 2 weeks, where you practice that at dinner time or at least 2 or 3 times a day every day. And then if you have a fenced-in yard, then I go out in the yard and do the same thing on a patio or a deck. Or if you don't have a patio or a deck, you're going to have two people out in the yard doing the same thing, Rover come and call it back and forth. The third stage is to follow the dog around in the yard and don't call it except when it looks at you. And every time it looks at you, give it the hand signal and say, Rover, come, call it over, have it sit. And then say, go play some more. Because one of the problems people have is they only call the dog when play's over. And so that's where I would get started on that.
All right. Well, Michelle, Julie, Buck, and Melissa, I'm sorry we couldn't get to all your calls. Dr. Hunhausen will be back with us again in a few weeks. Wayne, always good to have you. Thanks for taking the time.
Always good to be here. Thank you.
That's Dr. Wayne Hunhausen. He's a veterinarian and pet behavior consultant. He works at the Westwood Animal Hospital. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. ExxonMobil operates in more than 200 nations and territories, yet despite its global influence, the corporation's history and current practices remain an enigma. Tomorrow on the program, we'll unearth some of ExxonMobil's secrets. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, Caitlin Brennan, and Sangeeta Sastry. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.